Today, we are critiquing Beyond the Midas Mars Trap, which is basically an academic white paper proposing a massive civilizational shift from militarized claim protection to a security model based entirely on human and ecological well-being. And we are just jumping straight into the feedback right now.
Yeah, let's get right into it.
So as I understand it from the notes, the core argument here is that society has historically conflated genuine defense with the aggressive protection of financial claims, right? And that's what yields this Midas Mars trap.
Exactly. The idea that our militarized economy is basically a trap we've slowly just come to accept as security.
Right. Okay, so what I really like about this part is the vivid mythological counter-archetype the author brought out. The image of Irene holding Plutus, basically symbolizing how peace actually nurtures true prosperity.
Yeah, the foundational concept is incredibly strong. I mean, the distinction the author makes between death provisioning and life provisioning is exceptionally sharp.
It really is.
It completely reframes how we look at federal budgets and societal priorities. And I also have, you know, genuine enthusiasm for the concept of the insecurity blanket and that no one disposable ethical center.
Yeah, it gives it a really good moral weight.
Right. They provide a rock solid moral anchor for the entire piece. But to make sure these concepts actually land with maximum impact on the people who need to implement them, we really need to look closely at how they're being delivered to the reader.
Definitely. Let's look closely at the section discussing the core definitions. The vocabulary has this impressive, almost architectural depth to it, but I want to offer an analogy based on the author's own medical background, actually.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, so in medicine, a doctor needs complex, Latin-heavy terminology for the medical chart, right? It ensures absolute precision when communicating with other specialists. But when that same doctor turns around to speak to the patient in the room, they need plain, accessible language.
Right. They don't say myocardial infarction.
Exactly. They just say heart attack. It feels to me like this text sometimes writes for the chart rather than the patient.
That is a perfect way to put it. The profound conceptual architecture of this paper sometimes risks obscuring its practical urgency due to a reliance on highly specialized terminology.
Right. Like, I'm looking at the introduction and the abstract right now, and we're getting hit with concepts like conserved drift and life-coherent ontoxiology almost immediately.
Yeah, it's a lot. The weakness here is that leans so heavily on intricate academic phrasing creates a formidable barrier right out of the gate.
Yeah, it's a bit of a wall.
Exactly. While it's intellectually rigorous to use a term like claim capacity, this lexical density might alienate the exact audience of civic leaders, policymakers, and activists who actually need to operationalize this framework on the ground.
But let me push back a bit on that. I mean, this is an academic white paper. Isn't precision kind of the entire point?
Sure, but...
Like, if they strip out terms like ontoaxiology, don't they lose the philosophical weight that proves to their peers they've done the deep ontological work?
Well, they don't need to strip it out completely, but they do need to change the order of operations. You know, you can keep the philosophical weight without asking the reader to carry it all on page one.
Okay.
The suggestion here is to translate this specialized academic shorthand into plain language equivalents first. Or better yet, to immediately anchor the abstract concepts with visceral, everyday scenarios before explaining the dense theory behind them.
Oh, I see. So you ground the abstraction in dirt and concrete before elevating it to theory.
Precisely. You have to build a ramp up to the concept. So, for concrete examples, instead of introducing a term like claim capacity in a purely abstract sense in the opening pages, the text could immediately contrast a heavily defended, military-backed oil pipeline with an unfunded local water treatment plant.
Okay, yeah, I see that. The pipeline basically represents the financial claim, and the water plant represents the life ground.
Yes, exactly. You show the pipeline, you show the water plant, you explain how billions of dollars flow to protect the former, while the latter is just left to rust.
Right.
Then, once the reader is frustrated and fully engaged with that reality, you give it the label claim capacity. You make the reader crave the terminology to describe the systemic injustice they just witnessed.
Wow, that is a great mechanism for writing, because you are shifting the burden of translation off the reader's shoulders.
Totally.
But what about the executive summary? Because if a policymaker is reading this on a crowded commute, a phrase like conserved civilizational coupling might just bounce right off their cognition.
Yeah, In the executive summary, you could replace phrases like conserved civilizational coupling with something punchy and direct, like entrenched habits of funding and force.
Entrenched habits of funding and force. I like that. It still sounds smart. It still has that academic cadence, but I instantly know what it means.
Exactly.
It's about how deeply we're locked into spending money on weapons out of pure momentum.
Right. These are just a few ways to keep the profound insights accessible. You know, you don't have to dumb down the concepts. You just have to give the reader a tangible handhold before pulling them up into the theory.
Yeah, that makes sense. But let's say the author does that. Let's say they clarify the language. That actually creates a conceptual bridge to our next issue.
How so?
Because if the language needs to be more immediate to keep the reader engaged, the structural pacing of the argument must also carry the reader forward without stalling. So, a key theme running through this material seems to be the massive integration of disparate disciplines, right? Like economics, psychology, sociology.
Oh, yeah. It is a massive synthesis. It's really trying to pull together a unified theory of why we over-militarize.
It is. But then sections 5 through 8 dedicate individual chapters to summarizing force-specific theorists. We get McMurtry on the military paradigm, Galtung on psychopolitics, Ruloffs on the insecurity blanket, and Gaffney on defenses of private subsidy.
Yeah.
This structure kind of segregates the disciplines rather than integrating them.
That's a really sharp observation. The sequential presentation of the four foundational theorists disrupts the momentum of the core argument by adopting the pacing of a traditional academic literature review.
Yeah, it acts almost like a structural speed bump. Like I'm cruising along learning about the Midas Mars trap, and suddenly I have to read four separate book reports.
Right, exactly. The weakness is that by stacking McMurtry, Galtung, Ruloffs, and Gaffney one after another in these isolated silos, the text temporarily sidelines the author's own powerful original voice.
It really does.
It noticeably slows the narrative drive from the initial diagnosis of the trap to the ultimate pathways for conversion.
Wait, but again, playing devil's advocate here. If they are submitting this to an academic body or a think tank, won't stripping out a dedicated literature review get them penalized by their peers? Like, the Academy trains writers to show their work and rigorously prove their theoretical lineage.
I mean, that is a fair concern for a dissertation, but in a forward-looking policy white paper, the author is the authority.
Ah, right.
Right. Right now, these theorists are like four separate guest speakers taking the microphone away from the author in the middle of a keynote address.
Oh, that's a great way to think about it.
You don't want them giving separate speeches. You want them in the backup choir while the author sings lead.
Nice.
So the suggestion here is to disband those isolated theorist chapters and instead weave their court insights thematically directly into the paper's original problem-solution narrative.
I see. So instead of an entire chapter titled, you know, here's what Joan Ruloffs thinks about the economy, it becomes, here's the economic problem we are facing today, and as Ruloffs points out, this acts as an insecurity blanket.
Exactly. You extract the utility of their theory and install it into your own argument. Let's look at concrete examples of how a writer mechanically does this in the text.
Yeah, let's hear it.
The author could integrate Joan Ruloff's concept of the insecurity blanket directly into Section 4. The author already has brilliant, hard, empirical data in Section 4, like the fact that $1 billion in military spending yields 11,200 jobs, while that exact same investment in education yields over 26,000 jobs.
Right. Those empirical contrasts are some of the strongest parts of the paper, honestly.
Absolutely. So when you move Ruloffs into that section, don't just quote her in isolation. Use her concept as the lens to explain the job data you just presented.
Oh, I see.
You show the data and then use her theory of the insecurity blanket to explain why that data exists, why local communities desperately cling to those 11,000 defense jobs, even when education would create far more. You marry the theory directly to the data.
That is incredibly actionable. And what about Galtung and McMurtry? Because they deal heavily with the psychology and the false logic of militarization. How do we weave them in?
Well, you merge Galtung's psychological insights regarding chosenness, myths, and traumas, which is basically how a nation mentally justifies its own aggression. You merge that with McMurtry's false sequence of military necessity.
Okay.
By combining those, you create a single, highly dynamic section focused entirely on the psychology and logic of militarized justification.
That makes the text so much more aerodynamic.
Like, the reader isn't learning about Galtung as a historical figure. They are actively using Galtung's framework to see the very modern crisis the author is pointing at.
Right.
It fundamentally changes the reading experience from a passive absorption of history to an active engagement with a solution.
It really does. It keeps the focus squarely on the ideas rather than the authors. And that seamlessly moves the reader toward the life-coherent coupling audit without breaking the narrative spell. When the reader arrives at the actual policy proposals, they arrive with full momentum.
But let's say the author nails this. They streamline the text, the reader gets to the end, and they are fully convinced by the economic argument for conversion.
Okay.
The very next thing that reader is going to do is test this utopian idea against a dystopian reality. I can see what you're going for here in the text with the life-coherent conversion pathways, things like worker guarantees and life-ground procurement, but let's see how we can strengthen this by addressing the geopolitical reality gap.
Yeah, that's the big one.
Because what happens when a neighboring state decides to invade? Does a peace-inclusive ESG standard or an ecological security metric protect a nation's border in the short term from a neighboring state that is actively, aggressively operating under the old Mars Doctrine?
Yeah, the framework for economic conversion is materially robust, but leaves an unprotected flank regarding the immediate geopolitical risks of the transition period.
It's the elephant in the room. Like, you can't just audit your way out of an incoming ballistic missile.
You really can't. That is the brutal reality of international relations. The weakness here is that by focusing predominantly on the internal, domestic dependencies of the military-industrial complex, you know, the jobs, the universities, the budgets, the paper skips over the most obvious counterargument.
Right.
How does a state safely begin unilateral or asymmetrical demilitarization when hostile external actors are actively utilizing militarized threat right now?
Yeah. If I am a civic leader reading this, and I'm asked to champion this life-coherent transition, my very first question is going to be about state vulnerability. If we uncouple our economy from our massive defense infrastructure, are we just inviting predators who haven't adopted this enlightened framework yet?
Exactly.
It feels like we're being asked to disarm in a room full of people who are still holding loaded weapons.
And the author has to anticipate that exact fear because it is the primary psychological barrier to reducing military spending. The suggestion is to introduce a dedicated section that explicitly acknowledges the real-world friction of state vulnerability during the transition phase, detailing exactly how common defense operates against active, conventional aggression while the economic conversion is taking place.
So it's about owning the counterargument before the critic can even form it in their mind. You have to prove that life coherence does not equal defenselessness.
Exactly. For concrete examples, the author should explicitly model a transitional scenario. They need to detail how a state maintains targeted, non-expansive defensive capabilities strictly to deter invasion, while simultaneously, in the background, decoupling its economy from overseas claim protection.
But how do they draw that line in the text? Because I imagine some readers might argue that maintaining any defensive capability just keeps the Midas Mars trap alive. Like, if we still have missiles, aren't we still in the trap?
That is exactly why the distinction between common defense and claim protection has to do the heavy lifting here.
Okay, walk me through that.
Let's say we're talking about a radar, an air defense system. You have to make it crystal clear in the writing that maintaining an air defense system to protect a civilian watershed or a major population center from getting bombed is fundamentally different from projecting naval power across the globe to protect a corporate oil concession.
Ah, I see. So one is life provisioning, protecting the physical existence of the people, and the other is death provisioning, threatening violence to secure a financial asset abroad.
Right. And you have to show the mechanics of that de-escalation phase. Discuss how rapid diplomatic de-escalation, localized resilience, and nonviolent defense strategies actively bridge the highly vulnerable gap between our current Mars reality and the ultimate Irene Plutos ideal.
Can we talk about that diplomatic de-escalation for a second? Because I feel like that's the glue holding this transition together.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not just, hey, we put down our guns and hope for the best. It has to be an active diplomatic offensive, right?
Yes. The author needs to explain how this works functionally. When a state begins this conversion, they don't just quietly shrink their military and hide. They loudly and transparently shift their geopolitical posture to non-provocative defense.
Interesting.
They invite international observers, they sign non-aggression pacts, and critically, they redirect their massive defense budget into international aid and climate resilience, which actually drains the justification for hostility from neighboring states.
I love that. You're effectively weaponizing peace.
Yeah.
By becoming the largest provider of life ground support, like disaster relief, medical aid, infrastructure, you make yourself too valuable to the global community to attack.
Precisely. And spelling out those mechanics completely preempts the cynic's critique. It shows the reader that the author isn't just a utopian dreamer, but a pragmatic strategist who deeply understands the brutal mechanics of hostile geopolitics and knows exactly how to dismantle them safely.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
By explicitly mapping out how a state survives the chaotic transition period, you bulletproof the entire thesis.
This has been a deeply enriching analysis of a truly vital piece of writing. Let's just recap the three main pillars we've discussed for elevating this manuscript.
Sounds good.
First, we looked at tone and style. The goal is to soften the lexical density to align the tone with a broader policy audience, and the actionable step here is to translate heavy academic jargon into concrete, visceral scenarios early in the text, showing the pipeline versus the water plant before introducing abstract concepts like claim capacity.
Exactly.
Second, we addressed structure and flow. We need to eliminate the structural speed bumps. The actionable step is to restructure the isolated theorist summaries in sections 5 through 8, dissolving them into the surrounding thematic chapters. By merging the thinkers directly into the problem-solution narrative, using them as backup singers rather than guest speakers, you maintain narrative momentum and keep the focus on the actual ideas.
Yeah, keep that momentum going.
Finally, we looked at completeness and focus. To bolster the argument, the text must proactively address the counterargument of short-term geopolitical vulnerability. The actionable step is to add a targeted section detailing how a nation practically manages external state aggression through non-provocative common defense and aggressive diplomatic de-escalation during the friction-heavy transition period away from the Mars system.
Implementing those three structural shifts will take a manuscript that is already intellectually profound and make it practically unstoppable in the hands of the policymakers who actually need to read it.
A civilizational trap relies on being invisible. It relies on people accepting it as just the normal background noise of security. This white paper has the power to make that trap visible so it can finally be dismantled. We want to sincerely thank the listener for submitting this incredibly profound, necessary work. We invite you to apply these revisions, challenge the structure, and submit the updated material back in for another critique. Keep writing and keep refining the path forward.